From the studios of Boise State Public Radio News, I'm Gemma Gaudette. This is Idaho Matters. It's Friday, which means it's time for our reporter roundtable. We will get you updated on the news that made headlines this last week. And today, our panel includes Nicole Blanchard with the Idaho Statesman, Nate Eaton, news director at eastidahonews.com, and Logan Finney with Idaho Reports at Idaho Public Television. Happy Friday, everybody.
Hey, Gemma. Happy Friday.
So, Logan, let's begin with the news that has been making headlines all week long. This is the presidential election. You had a chance to speak with Idaho's chair of the Democratic Party. Talk to us about what she said about this shift from Biden to Harris at the top of the Democratic ticket.
Yeah, totally. In case any listeners have been living under a rock for the last, it hasn't even been a full week yet, Gemma. How crazy is that?
I know.
Incumbent President Joe Biden has announced he is no longer seeking re-election in 2024, and the Democratic Party has pretty rapidly coalesced around Vice President Kamala Harris to be their nominee this November. Of course, she will be running against, presumably she will be running against former President Donald Trump. And yes, I spoke with Representative Laura Necochea. She's a state rep from Boise, and she also serves as the chair of the Idaho Democrats. She is optimistic. She was looking forward to the convention. As your listeners may know, the RNC, the Republican National Convention, was earlier this month. That's where Trump was formally nominated, and he's announced his selection of J.D. Vance as his running mate. The Democrats, their convention is not until next month, so that's going to be August 19th to 22nd, and that's where they will officially name their nominee. But pretty much all of the delegates across the board largely are lining up behind Harris to support her. And I spoke with Necochea on the Idaho Reports podcast this week. You can listen to that wherever you find your podcasts. But I believe you guys have a clip from that conversation ready to go here.
Oh, unfortunately, Logan, I was just told that we don't have that clip. But if you could kind of give us a little bit of more information about what Necochea said, that would be great.
Yeah, not a problem. She's optimistic. She said that she said that no one really reached out to the Idaho delegation trying to whip their votes or anything like that. We've kind of seen some news coverage in the national political sphere where some of the Harris campaign people were reaching out to some delegations to try and get support lined up. But Necochea said within a couple hours after the news broke that Biden announced he was no longer running, she was on a call with all of the top Democrats across the state of Idaho. And she said it's a pretty logical, natural next step to go with Harris. I mean, that's the whole reason you have a vice president, right? Is to have someone who's a second option, second in line. And she said that the party is very optimistic. They think she's a really experienced candidate between her time as a local prosecutor and as Attorney General of California. And of course, she spent the last 4 years as vice president as the understudy to President Biden. So Necochea argued that she has the necessary experience and is going to run a strong campaign.
All right. Well, thanks for the update on that. I have to say, it is the news I think that's been making the headlines all week and will continue to make headlines probably into the weekend. But with that said, Nicole, I want to talk a little bit about a story that you wrote recently in regards to abortion bans. So, and I'm sure a lot of our listeners know this, but Idaho has one of the strictest abortion bans in the country. Now, we do have exceptions for rape and incest, but Nicole, you reported on something that I think is really interesting and something that folks should be aware of. And there is a really big barrier that a lot of these victims could be facing when it comes to their ability to access an abortion.
Yeah, Gemma. So if somebody reports that they have been a victim of rape or incest, they are, under Idaho's abortion ban, allowed to get an abortion up to the first trimester, but they do have to report that crime to law enforcement. And what I found in looking into how this would work is that there's really no protocol. Nobody really seems to know exactly how somebody would go through that process if they needed to. And one thing that I found especially concerning is we had at least one law enforcement agency here in the Treasure Valley I spoke with who had denied some victims of rape their police reports. And so if those people had become pregnant and had wanted to get an abortion, they would not have had a police report to substantiate to a physician in Idaho to say that, Yes, they did go through the proper channels and they do qualify for this exception. And so that it was Nampa Police Department who said that they had denied a handful, and they said that they will be changing their protocol after they realized that they had this issue. And so hopefully there's more of a standard at our different law enforcement agencies, but there's really no kind of set steps for people to follow.
So with that said, Nicole, if I'm hearing you right, these people that were denied the police report, is that there was an actual police report when they requested it, they were not given their own police report about
Correct.
okay. And
About the
so
crime that they
now,
reported. Yep.
okay. And so now, after you've done this reporting, hopefully we're going to see some change, at least when people request their own police report.
I know for sure that Nampa said it would implement something. I spoke with the Canyon County and Ada County Sheriff's offices and the police departments in Boise and Meridian and Caldwell. And all of them said, we are happy to work with people who report these crimes to make sure that they have access to their reports. But part of the other obstacle, as I mentioned, is, after you get this report, nobody really knows what happens. There's not a sequence of events where you then go to a certain office at a hospital or contact a certain advocacy agency or anything like that to kind of help you work through the process. So even if you are able to get your report, as is required by law at this point, it's really unclear what happens next.
Okay, because they put the law into effect, but didn't put any steps in place. Except for you have to
Correct.
have a police report. Okay. All
Correct.
right.
And I reached out to the legislators who sponsored that legislation to see what they had envisioned, and unfortunately, neither of them responded.
Well, I appreciate that reporting on that, Nicole. Good information for people to
Thank
have
you.
and to understand how that works. Nate, let's head over to you over in East Idaho because my goodness, I saw this video earlier this week at Biscuit Basin in Yellowstone National Park. I mean, Nate, it looks like something out of a movie. What in the
Right.
world happened?
Yeah, in fact, when this happened, people started sending us the video and we thought this is AI. This is doctored.
Yeah,
This is real.
right.
For those that haven't seen the video, it's about a geyser. It's about 100 feet into the air. I'm not exaggerating when I say that, and it looks like it's black water and steam and rock and dirt. And there's tourists that are on this boardwalk walking along, and suddenly they say, "Run, run." And turns out it is real. It's not AI. It was a big hydrothermal explosion at Biscuit Basin. It's amazing nobody was injured, but the wooden walkway there is completely destroyed. And what they're saying is that these things actually happen more than we might think, but to actually
Oh.
witness one and get it on camera is pretty remarkable. Just the day before, one of the scientists we spoke with the USGS said that there was a smaller hydrothermal explosion that had happened, nothing near this big. And they believe that this was a result of clogged passageways under the ground, basically. If you think of a big plumbing network under the ground of Yellowstone, there were basically some passageways that apparently were clogged and they just build up steam and pressure and heat. And that's when they explode. And that is what happened this past week.
I have to tell you, Nate, I mean, in all seriousness, that video is shocking. I mean, if I hadn't known it was real, I agree with you. I would have never thought it was real.
Right. And we some of the witnesses actually spoke out that got the video, and one of them said it looked like a black cloud just covering the sun. And imagine you're there walking along the walkway and suddenly this happens. You know, some of these geysers like Old Faithful, they time them out. They know when they're going to go off, you know what to expect. The public is kept far, far away from them. But others like this one at Biscuit Basin, people can get fairly close, but not now, not the rest of the season. They've shut it down to guests for the rest of the season. They have to rebuild the boardwalk. And scientists are hoping that they can learn from these type of explosions. In fact, on another geyser in the park, we've learned that they're putting in a tool, some sort of measurement gauge into the actual geyser that can help them figure out how often these things erupt, or at least maybe predict
when they might erupt at such force like this one did. So that would be fascinating if you can kind of figure out or predict when these things will happen. But I guess we'll see. This is a definitely one that people will remember. And again, it's incredible that nobody was hurt.
It really is incredible that no one was hurt. Yeah. Hey, Nicole, before we head into a break, let's talk about the latest. I mean, with these fires. So, I mean, all you have to do is look outside or smell the air and be, I mean, we are covered in smoke right now. So, two big fires, the Bench Lake Fire and the Durkee Fire. Let's start with the latest, on the Bench Lake Fire near Redfish Lake.
Sure. So I was on, I think last week, talking with you about the Bench Lake fire up by Redfish Lake. That fire, they've got quite a handle on it now, which is really encouraging. It's only about 2,500 acres at this point, and it is, I believe, about 60% contained. The really interesting news that came out today is that they have confirmed that the fire was human caused, which I think, with the recreation in that area and the lack of storms at the time that the fire started, I think a lot of us were expecting that news, but that has finally been confirmed. It sounds like they are about to start opening things back up as far as the recreation complex, the Redfish Lake Lodge, some of the campsites around there, will start reopening in the next couple of days. So there's some hopeful news from that side. And then
Okay, and yeah, then let's talk about the Durkee fire. This is burning exactly where in Oregon, Nicole?
so it is right along the state line between Idaho and Oregon, kind of near Weezer. And it's big. This one is about 280,000 acres, I believe, and it has only been burning for about a week. So it's been an intense one. It was started by some lightning, and it's close to a handful of other fires. So you've got the Badlands complex over there. You've got the, I believe, Cow Valley. So there's a whole lot, and that's where most of our smoke is coming from, is this collection of fires all in eastern Oregon. And those, they've got a bit of a handle on. I believe the Durkee is around 20% contained, but obviously they're having to apply a lot of resources to those.
And Nicole, this is the fire too that's closed I-84 down a couple of times. I mean, they've even had to close US Highway 20 down at some point. So I mean, for people who are traveling, I mean, that we could still see things like this happen.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is still a really large fire. It's actually the largest one currently burning in the US. And it's pretty unpredictable. And with the weather that we've been having, hopefully we're getting a little bit of a break in terms of the heat and the wind. But yeah, absolutely. Keep an eye on transportation information if you're trying to go anywhere along 84 because you're headed right in that direction.
Yeah, and I have to say, we actually had some good friends of ours get stuck, and it took them upwards of 2 days to get back to Boise because
Oh,
of all of the
wow.
closures that kept happening, right? So ever and even Highway 55, they've had to close that going up towards McCall because of fires. So everybody just basically be aware of, roads closing and opening up and everything. So all right, well, appreciate that update, Nicole, because man, this smoke is something. Logan, Idaho's Open Primary Initiative got enough signatures to be placed on the November ballot. However, this week, Attorney General Raul Labrador stated that he is suing to try and keep this initiative off the ballot. So let's begin. Can you start us off by just refreshing our memories on what this initiative is?
Sure. So if you're not one of the 97,000 people who signed on to this initiative, just a refresher is this would be a election reform measure. It would change Idaho's primary elections to a top four nonpartisan primary. So that would mean all the candidates from all the parties would run on one ballot. You would vote for your favorite out of all of those candidates, and then the top four in the race would go to the general election. And then the general election would also be modified to implement a ranked choice voting system. So you'd be able to rank the candidates in order of preference, with the idea being if no one gets a majority, more than 50% of the votes, the lowest ranking candidate is eliminated, and the votes for that candidate would go to those voters' second choices. The theory being you end up with candidates winning at the end of this process that would be more popular or more acceptable to a larger swath of the population. So this is a ballot initiative that's been in the works for a couple of years now. We've been covering it pretty closely through the process, and it is on its way to the ballot this November. That gets us to this week, where AG Labrador has announced he's filed a challenge to the initiative seeking to block it from getting onto the ballot.
Okay, so Logan, what is he saying about why he's suing? Like, what's his argument around this?
Sure. So Attorney General Raul Labrador, his argument is basically this was the signatures were gathered under some deceptive marketing is what he says. The coalition behind this, the Idahoans for Open Primaries group, and the initiative is called the Open Primaries Initiative. And the issue that Labrador takes with that is Idaho used to have an open primary system prior to 2011. And the way that system worked was, so the primaries were still partisan. If you were a Republican and you got the Republican ballot, you got all the Republican candidates for the offices. But when it was an open primary, you didn't necessarily have to be registered as a Republican to get that Republican ballot. Same goes for the Democrats, for the Libertarians, et cetera. And so Labrador says, his argument is basically this initiative group has been dishonest or deceptive with the voters, because calling it an open primary system in the attorney general's eyes implies we would be going back to this system prior to 2011. And that's kind of the way that this initiative has been pitched, is if we go to an open primary process, you get more moderate or less extreme candidates coming out of those primaries. And so Labrador is challenging this ballot initiative on the grounds that people are expecting, his argument is, the people who signed this initiative are expecting, if it takes effect, to go back to the pre-2011 process where it's an open Republican primary, an open Democratic primary, etc. But actually, if the initiative took effect, it would be one combined open primary. So that's Labrador's argument, is it's the under state law, you can't lie to people when you're collecting signatures and tell them an initiative would do one thing and do another thing. So he says that they're overselling this open primary aspect of it and underselling the ranked choice voting element. And his office is kind of has indicated that they were going to challenge this once it finally made it toward the ballot. And so that's what's happened.
So what have we heard from the folks behind this initiative since AG Labrador filed suit?
Yes, they have been expecting this. They are not too worried about it. I have not seen their, I don't believe that they have filed a formal response to it yet, but their comments to reporters, I believe the story that we have up on our website is from our friend Kyle Fannensteel over at the Idaho Capital Sun. Folks with the Open Primaries Initiative are not too worried about this, and they say that whether it's a partisan or a nonpartisan primary, an open primary is an open primary in their eyes. And they say they've been upfront and honest with voters about both the open primary element and the ranked choice voting element of this initiative.
And so at this point now, Logan, we're just waiting to see what happens with the lawsuit and then moving forward with the ballot in November.
Yes. Yeah. Assuming that the attorney general is not successful, this ballot initiative would appear on the November 2024 ballot, along with the races for president and for all of the legislative and county offices. And yeah, it would be part of the general election.
It is going to be a big election night come November 5th.
Oh, yes.
Right. Nicole, Wednesday night, Idaho Power took some preventative measures and they actually turned off electricity to parts of the Treasure Valley. Can we talk a little bit about this? Because first off, why did Idaho Power decide to do this? I don't think they've done something like this before, have they?
Sure. So this was kind of a new initiative or a new plan that Idaho Power has in place. They're calling it a Public Safety Power Shutoff or PSPS plan. And this basically is becoming more popular across the West as we're having this really extreme increased fire weather, as we were just talking about. And the idea is to make sure that if a line comes down, if a power line is interrupted or broken somehow during a storm, that it's not going to become a fire hazard or a risk for ignition. And so they go ahead and preemptively de-electrify those lines that they're concerned about. So in this case, it was a lot of homes in the foothills and a lot of homes over in kind of the East End and Harris Ranch area that kind of butt right up against the foothills and a lot of that wildland urban interface area. And the thought process there is, we want to stop the potential for there to be an ignition before anything happens to these transmission lines.
And Nicole, is part of this due in part to the fact that Idaho Power, but other utilities as well across the country have been blamed for starting certain fires. I mean, we had one in 2008. I remember this very vividly, in Southeast Boise, and there was a fatality in that, and Idaho Power was accused of causing that fire.
Yeah, so Idaho Power has in the past been accused of causing fires with faulty equipment, or with transmission failures and other issues like that. And then obviously we've got some really high profile cases, the Maui fires in Hawaii in the last couple of years. I want to say the Paradise or the Camp Fire, one of the big fires that we
In
had.
California, yeah.
Yeah, over in California, and then a handful of Labor Day fires from, I believe, 2020 or 2022 over in Oregon, were caused by utilities not getting rid of electricity in lines where they were told there was extreme fire danger. And some of them have had to pay, tens of millions of dollars in damages. And so there is an incentive for them to turn off the electricity. And we're kind of left in this in between of, well, it's 105 degrees, so it's important for people to have electricity to be able to run their air conditioning, and be safe in
But
that
it's also
regard. But
important not to have fire.
exactly. And so, Idaho Power is kind of in between a rock and a hard place, and we'll see how that kind of starts to play out here.
Okay, thanks for that. Hey, Nate, I only have about a minute left, but I got to talk about this. There's a Bigfoot conference in Pocatello this weekend.
Yeah, you better make the drive out here, Gemma, because the Bigfoot Rendezvous is what it's called. And fans of Bigfoot, theorists, people who have theories about them can come out, and it's everything Bigfoot, including a keynote speaker. He's a professor of anatomy and anthropology at ISU. He's going to speak. He's one of the world's leading Sasquatch researchers. He's written a book, and he's known as a rock star in the Bigfoot community. So it happens tomorrow at the Westwood Mall in Pocatello. You can even dress up if you want.
Well, I have to tell you, I grew up in the Pacific Northwest. I think Bigfoot might be real. With that said, thank you all very much. I appreciate everyone's time. We've been talking with Nicole Blanchard with the Idaho Statesman, Nate Eaton, news director at eastidahonews.com, and Logan Finney with Idaho Reports. The Free Application for Federal Student Aid, or FAFSA, process was established back in 1992. It's a rite of passage for the majority of high school graduates here in the United States, and around 60% completed one last year. However, Idaho has routinely been among the bottom 10 states for participation, and as our Triopi reports, an update to the way the program works has pushed that number down even more.
Changes to the FAFSA rolled out by the Biden administration were supposed to streamline the process and allow more students to qualify. But the program's launch was delayed 3 months from last October to January.
And then once it did open, it has been riddled with errors and issues.
That's Jenny Kimball, College and Career Advising Program Manager for the Idaho State Board of Education. I first spoke with her in May.
It's been a rough couple of months for certainly our students and our families and our counselors and advisors who are helping those students fill it out.
For much of the last decade, about 44% of Gem State High School seniors completed the application, which determines college financial aid eligibility. This year, struggles with the new FAFSA have been blamed for dropping that number to less than 36% in Idaho and below 50% nationwide.
Our low-income, minority, first-generation to college students are really the ones who are struggling with this form the most.
Glitches in the software blocked users from correcting data they'd previously entered, didn't save signatures, and some forms were simply unavailable. Caldwell High School College and Career Counselor Jesse Stockdale says she saw frustrations play out firsthand.
About a third of our students that were maybe thinking about going have been completely discouraged and probably won't even try.
Caldwell schools have many low-income students that would likely qualify for federal Pell Grants and other financial support, but repeatedly, Stockdale saw those students stymied by the new process.
It's correlated so much with complicated life situations and other, you know, confounding factors that are going to make everything that they were presenting more difficult.
One of the most promoted new features, a data link to require tax information, didn't always work. When it didn't work reliably, explained the State Board of Education's Kimball.
A student who's a citizen, but their parent may not have a Social Security number, that parent has not been able to access the form. The form just would not work, even though it was supposed to.
Federal officials rolled out fixes to many issues, and more are expected, but they may be too late for some. Kimball says nearly 1,200 fewer FAFSA applications were completed in Idaho than the last cycle, and that's just high school seniors. Returning college students also have to renew their FAFSAs. Chris Collins is Associate Vice President for Enrollment at Boise State.
We've sent emails, we've made phone calls, we've sent text. So we're doing everything we can to communicate directly with students.
Boise State, like many schools, delayed deadlines as long as it could and tried to be as flexible as possible. But some students still missed out on potential scholarships or grants. Despite fewer FAFSA applications, Collins says overall enrollment at Boise State is actually trending up. She thinks the difference could be because students have been more selective in how many schools they send financial aid requests to.
They're only sending it out to the one or two schools that they're really considering.
The impact has been more pronounced at the private College of Idaho, says its vice president of enrollment, Brian Bava.
What went from, you know, like a 6-month window to work with families, you know, really explain to them that attending a private college like College of Idaho was possible was reduced even further to 6 weeks.
The couple hundred fewer FAFSA applications at C of I makes a big difference at a school of some 1,100 total students, he says. Nampa's Northwest Nazarene University says they weren't sure yet how enrollment might be affected. It's possible the uncertainty led some students to choose a lower sticker price of a public school. Boise State's enrollment is trending up. Enrollment at the University of Idaho is up. But U of I Associate Vice President for Enrollment, Dean Kaler, says he's most worried about the students he doesn't know about, who never asked for help.
I'm really concerned about those students and families. And, you know, they're trying to navigate it, and they may not have anybody that they can go to for a resource.
This spring, the Biden administration gave states millions of dollars for FAFSA outreach and assistance this summer. That's paid for dozens of pop-up support locations across Idaho since June. Kimball, with the State Education Board, says those sessions targeted underserved populations and have led to about 100 completed applications. The free sessions continue into August. The State Board of Education is recommending anyone still working to complete a FAFSA do so by the end of this month to get the best chance at receiving financial aid this fall. Meanwhile, college admissions offices say they're already behind in preparing for next year's FAFSA cycle, and the federal government hasn't said whether the application would be available on time October 1st or not. But Bava, the enrollment administrator, is cautiously optimistic the next cycle will be smoother.
To go through this again would be just unreasonable, frankly, and unacceptable.
Troy Oppie, Boise State Public Radio News.
And Troy is joining us now to talk more about this. Good to have you back on the show, Troy.
Glad to be here, Gemma.
So, Troy, how big of a deal is this for kids who want to go to college?
Well, it is a big deal because it opens doors to financial aid, federal Pell Grants, which are grants, but also scholarships and other types of financial aid. Basically, families, many of you listening, I'm sure, have gone through this if you have older children. I remember it from 25 years ago. You have to compile all your assets and income and give a picture of your financial situation, ultimately, to the schools that you're applying to. And the schools take that information and they formulate how much financial aid and what should the offer be to this particular student. And then you take that information and you combine it with kind of the cost of living, what you're going to pay for housing, where you want to go to school, the programs offered, and you make your college decision. This is a big deal, starting with the delay, because normally the window to complete this work opens in October, in the fall, for enrollment almost a year down the road. Well, this year, that window didn't even open until January. As you heard, there were so many glitches and so many hurdles for so many different groups of people that a lot of these deadlines got kind of missed. And so you had students facing enrollment deadlines or, as we'll hear in a minute, an enrollment fee for intent to enroll, and they didn't necessarily know what their financial aid picture was going to look like. And imagine trying to make a college decision if you don't know where the money's going to come from or how you're going to pay for it. So yeah, it is a big deal. And a lot of these problems, as I mentioned in the story, you know, the Department of Education has fixed a lot of these glitches, and they've cut down the processing time for when you complete your FAFSA, it goes back to the Department of Education, they process it, and then it gets sent to the schools. That processing time was down to between 3 and 5 days this spring. That helped a great deal, but everybody was still months behind. Students, schools, everybody.
So, Troy, I mean, because of this, is it really discouraging students from going on to college right now?
Yeah, I think what the Caldwell High School counselor, Jesse Stockdale, had to say was really enlightening there, where you have a student population in Caldwell that is higher on the low-income scale than many other schools across the state of Idaho. And, you know, students there would benefit from as much financial aid as possible if they want to go on. Completing the process, especially as we heard, for complicated life situations, if there's a split in the household, if there's income disparities between split households, students' parents, maybe they're not in communication with one side of the family, and certainly different citizenship statuses between parents and students got really, really complicated. And in a school like Caldwell that has the demographics that it does, that made a big difference. You can go on to the National College Attainment Network's website. This is the data clearinghouse where a lot of these statistics come from that tracks all this. And you can get very granular, and you can look at a school within a state to see what their FAFSA completion rates are, how much they changed year to year. And I'll stay high level right now, just looking at the state of Idaho, we're down to 35.7% completion rate as of July 5th, and that is an 11-point reduction from the previous cycle. And you saw year-over-year more than 11% decline in higher-income schools, but a more than 14% decline in participation for low-income schools. You saw a 10% change to the negative of participation for non-minority or low-minority student groups, and you saw more than a 20% decline in participation in Idaho from high-minority groups. So the data really show what school student counselors and what folks in the State Department of Education were seeing.
Mm-hmm. So Troy, where do college admissions folks come into this? I mean, are they pushing students across the finish line?
They have, and as we heard Chris Collins at Boise State say, they were really trying to beat down the doors of students who were already on campus who have to renew their FAFSAs, and you know, in some cases, they did the FAFSA for the first time the old way the previous year, and now they've got to adjust to the new way. But they had those students on campus. They had telephone numbers and emails, and they could get out and have sessions on campus to flag down students and say, look, you got to get this done. Here's where the challenges are. Give yourself extra time here, here, and here. That applied to renewing students. It was a bit trickier to get students at the high school level across the finish line, as it were. But the other lever that colleges had to pull, if you will, was changing some of their deadlines. And here's Jenny Kimball with the College of Career and Advising Program for the state of Idaho, the Board of Education, kind of explaining how her department was guiding colleges earlier this spring.
We have seen institutions like Boise State push back their intent to enroll to June, which we were very pleased about. A lot of the other institutions in the state don't necessarily have that definitive deposit or a deadline, but because they have things like housing applications or orientation or things like that, that still require students to sort of make a choice and sometimes pay a fee, we're asking them to really look at those and consider extending those deadlines.
I heard this story from colleges that I talked to across the board. They were as flexible as they could possibly be with a lot of these deadlines. But one place that a lot of flexibility was not found was in scholarship program deadlines. And Kimball told me that the Idaho Opportunity Scholarship had a record number of new student applications this year, about 10,000. And about a third of those were disqualified because the FAFSAs were not completed and submitted by the Idaho Opportunity Scholarship Program deadline. Now, the practical effect of this wasn't as bad as it maybe sounds, and that's because there was also a high number of existing college students renewing their Idaho Opportunity Scholarship, and most of the pool of scholarship funds went to those renewing students. They didn't have to submit a new FAFSA in order to renew. So there wasn't a lot of money in that scholarship program left over to fund new students, and therefore you didn't even have everybody that did get all their paperwork in under the deadline receiving money through the Idaho Opportunity Scholarship. In a different year, Kimball told me, that might have been different and the effect might have been more pronounced. But that's a kind of a real world example of how the FAFSA delay could cost some students.
So, Troy, before we wrap up, you mentioned the Department of Education has fixed a lot of these issues. Mm-hmm. But there's really kind of only a cautious optimism that the next cycle will be better.
Yeah. And you know, the glitches were really, you know, colleges and guidance counselors got their instructions. This is how we need to do this form. And then when they went to share those instructions with students and families, the forms just didn't work, right? And that's a hurdle that in many cases, it sounds like has been corrected and fixed. But there still are a lot of issues behind the scenes that it sounds like need to go better to have a smooth experience. There has not been, at this point, an announcement that the new FAFSA application window will open, as it has in previous years, on October 1st. And certainly, admissions departments are already months behind in the preparation that they need to do and want to do ahead of that typically October 1st date. So we'll see. Cautious optimism sounds like it is the word of the day. But as you heard Brian Bava, the Vice President for Enrollment at the College of Idaho, say, they can't go through this again. It wasn't fair to anybody.
Well, Troy, as always, we just appreciate your reporting on this. Thanks for coming in.
Glad to be here.
Thanks so much for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you tomorrow.
Here at Shortwave Space Camp, we escape our everyday lives to explore the mysteries and quirks of the universe. We find weird, fun, interesting stories that explain how the cosmos is partying all around us. From stars to dwarf planets to black holes and beyond, we've got you. Listen now to the Shortwave podcast from NPR.